Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Last year, the number of international adoptions fell to a 15-year low. And just 2 weeks ago, Vladimir Putin passed a ban on U.S. parents adopting Russian children. So let's look at supply, demand, and the best interests of the child. Adam Pertman is the executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. He's an adoptive parent himself and author of Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families and America. Thank you so much for joining us, Adam. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And let's start with Russia. What really precipitated that ban?
Oh, my. Well, it wasn't the best interests of children. Let's start with that. The U.S. in June 2012, because it took a while to get through, passed a law that was in response to the death in a Russian prison, in a Moscow prison, of a guy named Sergei Magnitsky. He was a lawyer and auditor. He had exposed massive fraud involving Russian tax officials. He was jailed. He died in jail. The U.S. responded by saying the human rights of this man were violated. The people who did it are going to have sanctions imposed against them, mainly dealing with banking and travel to the U.S. Putin called that a horrible step in. He said it poisons our relationship, as I recall, with the United States. So the Russians wanted to retaliate, essentially. And what the weapon they chose was a ban on U.S. adoptions of Russian children.
And I'm curious, speaking about the best interests of the children, because I think we tend to think about this ban in terms of the American parents who are now denied the children they thought they were going to adopt, which is
right.
A tragedy. But how many children were on the verge of being placed in homes, U.S. homes, who may be living in orphanages or other institutions or untenable circumstances in Russia? Does anybody know the number?
Well, you pointed to the problem. I mean, that is the bottom line in my mind as well. We don't know the exact number. We think a few dozen children were in what's called the pipeline, you know, in the real process, mm-hmm. legal process of being adopted. We hope that some or all of them can complete the process. It doesn't look like it at this moment. That doesn't mean it won't happen. But they are certainly the biggest immediate victims. Some of them, I mean, none of these kids are babies. These are older children. And some of them have called their American parents mommy and daddy. Mm. I mean, they were expecting to leave
wow.
and go home to the U.S. So that is the deepest tragedy. We know that under 1,000 kids were adopted by Americans from Russia last year. There's every reason to think, you know, some hundreds of children would have been this year, and they will stay in orphanages. They will stay in institutions instead of going to families.
Listeners, we want to open up the phones on this. If you've recently been going through the long, complicated process of adopting a child from another country, please call and tell us about your experience. We'd also love to hear from anyone with ties to Russia who can talk about that ban. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post your comment or your story to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show as we continue with with Adam Pertman, who's the director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute and author of the book Adoption Nation. And as we mentioned now, looking beyond Russia, international adoption has been in decline worldwide for a while. Why is that, and which countries are we mostly talking about?
Sure. Well, we're talking about most countries, unfortunately, and the reasons are diverse, but they have common threads. The big one that I identify is the world started watching. I mean, not 15 years ago, there was no big framework for international adoptions. There is now. It's called the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption, and it tries to impose standards and training and all sorts of good things on the process. Not all countries could meet the standards. Not all agencies can meet the standards. And so that has certainly been a factor, and a lot of individual country factors. And again, the world started watching. So when the world, 15 years ago, all the stories were, isn't it all wonderful? children are getting homes from Romania and China and Russia and Guatemala, and, you know, all is well. Well, we started paying attention, and the media started paying attention, and policymakers, and there were flaws, there were problems, there was some fraud. And almost every country, including our own, for the most part, adopted a all-or-nothing policy. You know, either all adoptions from this country can proceed or none will proceed, and certainly Russia went that route, instead of sort of figuring out which ones are okay, which ones are, you know, questionable. And as we started watching and finding problems, Guatemala, in answer to your question, Guatemala closed. It was one of the biggest, what we call sending countries for adoption in the world. It closed and hasn't reopened. China has retrenched enormously for its, again, particular own reasons. They, among others, they discovered they couldn't live without any girls. You know, they were losing a lot of their girls. And now it takes 3 to 5 years to adopt from China, and mostly it's older children who have special, and kids with special needs. Now you see what happened to Russia. Similar things happened in Vietnam. Korea, very different. They have had a more child-centered, child welfare-centered retrenchment process that's taken decades, in which they have tried to build up the care of children within their own country. And as they have, the numbers placed for adoption elsewhere have gone down. That's a sort of a more reasoned, child-centered approach.
Let's take a call from somebody with a China story. Lisa in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, thank you so much. I really love your show.
Thank you.
We have a 7-year-old adopted child from China, and we've been in the process for the past 5 years to adopt a second child from China. Since then, actually late last year, we got notification from our agency that they sold our dossier to another agency on the other side of the country, who is now asking us for an additional $5,000 to keep our dossier active in China. And the feeling that we get is that the agencies, especially those dealing with China and these countries that are closing, are just looking for ways to keep their businesses going. It's almost like a pyramid scheme. We feel like they're extorting money from us with false hope.
Is this a story you've heard before, Adam?
No, it's not. And I actually would love for listeners who have stories like this to send an email to info@adoptioninstitute.org, and I'd love to see what we can find out about it. What I do see is the number of agencies declining, because there simply are fewer and fewer adoptions. There are these rules, international rules now, and so fewer and fewer agencies. So I could certainly see how agencies are handing off, you know, consolidating and sending their clients to other people. But if they're trying to milk people as a part of the process, that does not sound so good to me.
Lisa, good luck. And if you want input from our guests, go ahead and use that email. There is a moral pecking order here, right? I would guess that, again, in the interest of the child, that if a baby could be placed, or even an older child, in his or her home country, that that's a better thing as a matter, you know, as a concept, than being placed for adoption in the United States. And there may be a difference in the financial means of the parents here on average, but that there's a certain, you know, real moral case to be made for domestic adoptions within any country if you can, right?
Absolutely. And I'm a big proponent, and we're doing actually a study right now on the Hague Convention and on best practices in inter-country adoption. And we will absolutely come out in favor of sort of a hierarchy. If kids can stay in their own family, that's first choice, and we should support that family. If kids can stay in their own country and culture, absolutely. But what we should not permit is for children to stay institutionalized. We know the consequences of institutionalization on children. They lose IQ points. They suffer developmental delays. Their prospects in life diminish every single month they are in that orphanage or other institution. So when Putin, for example, says, we are now going to take better care of our kids so that they can stay at home, well, that would be a good outcome, but that's a long-term outcome. That's something you can institute over time. What happens, even if he does it, what happens to the children in the next 5, 10, 20 years who don't benefit yet while they're putting all the good systems in place, while they're fostering an adoption culture within the country. What happens to those children who stay institutionalized? That's the prize we have to keep our eyes on.
Let's take another call. Here is Ellen in upstate New York. Ellen, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Brian. I'm curious as to why people adopt children from Russia instead of from the United States when there's so many children in foster care in the United States. And also, having worked on a child study team for many years, we had to evaluate many of the children who came from Russia who had emotional problems and ended up out of district schools because they were so severely traumatized from being in these orphanages.
Ellen, is there a reason that you think Americans go to other countries to adopt rather than adopting available American children?
No, I don't. I've always been curious about that because I've worked with foster children, and I know there's so many of them that want to be adopted.
Yes. Adam, we have more than...
I would be delighted to answer this question.
Go ahead. We have more than 10,000 children in foster care at any moment in New York City alone.
I love and hate this question all at once. It's maybe the most common question relating to international adoption generally, not just Russia. Why do people go abroad when there are kids right here? So, one, why are we pitting children against each other? I think we ought to have policies and practices in place to get the kids adopted within this country and help children anywhere who also need homes. I think that would be the best outcome, and pitting them against each other, implying that one child deserves a home more than another, is disturbing to me. But more to the point, it is exactly what Americans are doing. Last year, Americans adopted around 900 children from Russian orphanages, mainly kids who are older and with special needs, and they adopted about 52,000 children from foster care. It is exactly what is happening. And if it is incumbent on Americans to give homes to children from foster care, why is it only people who adopt from abroad? Why are you having your 30th IVF treatment when there are children right here who need homes? Why are you giving birth to your third child when there are children right here who need homes? By the way, I don't want to ask those questions. I think people should make their own judgments about how they build their families. But I don't think it's fair to those families who choose to adopt overseas or in any other way to question why they do it.
Is it true, though, that another reason could be foreign adoption is often less expensive than doing so domestically?
It depends how you do it. If you adopt from foster care, there are virtually no costs and sometimes subsidies involved. So there's no real money there. If you adopt an infant in this country or adopt a child from abroad, the costs are pretty similar, and they're horrific, by the way. They're like $30,000 to $50,000, but the costs are pretty similar.
So it's a lot harder for, let's say, an infertile, lower-income couple in the United States to adopt a baby because money is a factor.
You bet. I mean, the adoptions from foster care are typically by people with lower or middle incomes. Adoptions of infants within this country and children from abroad are generally people with high, middle, and upper incomes.
Sheila in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are you? I have three biological children and two children who are adopted from Russia. I did it, they were 6 months old, and they are now almost 16. So it was a while ago, and it was probably a much easier process. There was only one trip involved. But what we found out when we were there is that culturally it's just not acceptable in Russia to adopt a child that isn't related to you.
Culturally?
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
And not to mention financially, most Russian families don't have the resources. And
what
it was very expensive.
Adam?
What's true around the world, my book is called Adoption Nation because Americans adopt more children overseas or domestically in every way, more children than the rest of the world combined. We do have a more, if you will, adoption-friendly culture for reasons we can talk about. Most countries to this day think of family as being built solely by blood, by procreation. So this is what Korea has done over the decades, is try to build that adoption culture, that understanding of different types of families, and it takes real time. That's why I say even if Russia wants to do that domestically, it is going to take real time because it is not part of the fabric of people's understanding of how you build a family.
It'll be decades.
Sheila, thank you very much.
Okay.
So looking at domestic issues, one of the many contested points is the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations. Adoption was a point of contention in the fiscal cliff negotiations, adoption of all things. There was the adoption tax credit, which was made permanent on January 2nd. So tell us what that is and what that news means for American families.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't mean as much as one would hope it would mean. The adoption tax credit is something that you get after you adopt, and if you have taxes, you get a credit against them, depending on your income, up to a limit that I don't recall offhand. And it was meant to help people with their adoptions, promote adoption, and help children who need homes, especially children from foster care, special needs, and kids with special needs. Well, while it was made permanent this time, what was not done because of cost was there was no refundability clause. In other words, you can't get a refund. You can only have a credit against your taxes, which means that lower-income people, like we were just discussing, the ones who adopt from foster care, they don't get refunds. They don't have tax liabilities generally. And so now there's no refund. So the people who benefit least from the new tax credit, as it was passed by Congress for financial reasons, the people who benefit least are the people who give homes to children from foster care.
One more call. Michael in Elmont. You're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you, sir?
Good. You adopted from?
I adopted from Jamaica in the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And after the court had approved all the paperwork there, and I came to the United States, returned here, and I filed a form with USCIS. USCIS then asked me that I needed to fulfill the requirement of living 2 years with the child abroad. How could I possibly have done that?
Hmm. And by the way, for the sake of a lot of listeners who seem to be starting a conversation about why Americans adopt abroad in the first place, why did you, just to take an example of yourself, look to another country to adopt?
Well, first of all, my wife and I have 4 children here in the United States who are American citizens, and our children are very productive members of society. We went abroad on vacation. We saw a young lady that she had so many children, she couldn't even feed these kids. So we figured, well, do you want the child? The child was homeless, barely. And the child was only, I think she was 12 at the time. And we decided emotionally, we said, listen, you know, and financially, of course, we said, look, let's adopt the child. If the parents is willing to give up the child, if the parents don't want the child and can't afford to support, you know,
so you had really,
cognitively.
Yeah, so you had really already met this individual child and individual family. What about his question, Adam, before you go, as to a requirement that he live abroad with the child for 2 years before adopting the child? Have you ever heard of that before?
Every country has its own. We have to abide by the rules of the country, the quote, sending countries, the countries that place their children. I don't know every country's rules. This seems like an extreme one. But his case does not seem typical in any case. I mean, most people adopt because they do have compassion for children who need homes, or because their lineage, their heritage is from that particular country, for lots of reasons. This is an unusual case, and I don't know that particular country's rules, but they would have been that country's rules, not the U.S. rules.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but there is kind of this duality taking place, it seems now, where international adoption is rising in visibility, partly due to high-profile celebrities adopting from abroad, partly due to Modern Family with the character Lily adopted from Vietnam, and yet there is a downward trend due to laws and other reasons with respect to international adoptions. Adam Pertman, Executive Director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute and author of Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families and America. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.